This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Anatoly Karlin. We'll be discussing his return to Russia and his predictions for this year 2017. Anatoly, it's great having you back on the show.
Great being with you again, as usual.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hey there. Hey.
So, Anatoly, on our last show, we talked about, I think when I talked to you last, you were still in London, and now you've returned to Moscow, Russia. And there was this commentator saying originally, you had this article, go back to Russia, and the context of that is like they were saying, oh, this guy, he's advocating this totalitarian government from like the safety and freedom of like sunny California, so why doesn't he go like live there? So you took his advice.
Well, that was tongue in cheek. I hope you realize.
I know.
Yeah. Basically, I was making fun of the fact that a lot of the people who have attacked my blogging, they say, "Oh, you're living in California, so why don't you vote with your feet and move back to Russia if you think it's so great?" Even though that's not my argument, I just think that the Western media gets a lot of things wrong about Russia, and I try to correct it. With facts and statistics, for instance. But anyway, some people have this really negative view of what I'm doing, and they use these not very good arguments to attack it. And when I do move back to Russia, so like any day now, I imagine, I imagine that they'll start attacking me for being a Putlia Shil who lives in Russia and who gets paid by Putin, and because I live in Russia, I can't trust anything I say here either, though, because Russia is this totalitarian regime, and even if I'm like disappointed by everything I see, then I'll have no choice but to continue my usual lying, as was the case when I was in California. So you can't really win with those people.
What type of person was that coming from? Are they kind of, was it more of a, were they like a neocon basically?
It wasn't really a specific person. It's just a set of people, I would say, or a set of mindsets who just don't like what I'm writing and would use any sort of argument or quasi-argument to attack my viewpoints and my arguments.
Have you gotten attacked politically more from like the right wing, or more neocons, or more from like SJW types, or not? Or you don't get that if you have been attacked politically?
Well, before 2015, 2016, it was, of course, mostly the right wing, the neocons. Nowadays, it's mostly the left, because all the neocons have now gone to the left. That's what Donald Trump did. He put like the inverse, made the political system into the inverse of what it was with respect to Russia, especially. So it's even according to opinion polls before 2014, 2015, it was the Republicans and conservatives who didn't like Russia a lot more than the left and the liberals. And nowadays it's the exact opposite.
I think the neocons are actually kind of divided on Trump. And that's a fantastic thing, because that weakens their power. There's one faction of them that despises Trump for being friendly towards Russia, but then there's another faction that is friendlier towards Trump because they perceive him as being more pro-Israel than Obama and Hillary. So I think there's division. Would you say that's accurate?
Certainly, yes. There's a big division. So basically, you have the pot-hodditzers on one side who are really anti-Trump, and then you've got some of the neocons who instead have come down to Trump. So yeah, it's great that they're divided, I guess.
With Trump's policies, Are you optimistic about Trump in general, or do you think there's a good chance he could go in kind of a, like a mainstream Republican direction, like do all this stuff like a cut regulation for corporations, get rid of environmental protection, but then on the other hand, like still continue, do very little about like immigration? Do you think that that's a strong possibility?
I'm pretty optimistic about Trump, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. I mean, I'm not holding out much hope for him, like not doing anything about environmental regulations or anything, because I mean that's like he said he'd cut down on that. But with respect to foreign,
you're personally to the left of him on that issue.
Well, probably, but it's not a huge issue for me. So basically, my biggest issue, of course, is foreign policy. That's pretty much.
Do you see him fulfilling his promises on immigration and trade? I know he has had an impact with that carrier company mm-hmm. keeping jobs from going to Mexico.
I think he would, and his actions so far. I mean, people are expecting some kind of betrayal, especially those on the alt right. But so far, he's been pretty consistent with what he has been promising. So yes, he's been pressuring the companies to keep jobs, manufacturing jobs in the United States, and some of them are following suit. If he could create, a lot of mainstream economists are criticizing him for that. They're saying that it's not so efficient. But then again, if he could make it the new normal that companies are considered to be somewhat responsible for the communities in which they operate, then that would probably be a good development. And as the guy's foreign policy, as well, he's been pretty consistent. So he didn't have to say that he'd try to get along with Russia. In fact, I would say that politically it hurt him. So I don't think there's any particular reason for him to make a sudden sharp reversal on that. I mean, to be sure, Rex Tillerson, for instance, on the recent confirmation hearings, he hasn't been as favorably disposed to Russia. He was actually pretty anti-Russian then, but those are just the confirmation hearings. He has to get through that sort of filter, and after that, it becomes pretty irrelevant anyway. So overall, I think I'm pretty optimistic. I think that what Trump is doing, it syncs with what he has been promising.
You said you predict a divide in the alt-right over Trump, but over the issue of a civic nationalism versus ethno-nationalism. But I would say most of those people accept that Trump is a civic nationalist. They just want something done about immigration and trade policy. Do you see them being disappointed by him being a civic nationalist, or you see them being disappointed if he doesn't fulfill his promises on those issues?
Well, I think that the alt-right might have drunk the Kool-Aid and have started to imagine that perhaps Trump is actually a lot more radical than what he actually is. So, for instance, he's never said anything about affirmative action. For instance, he seems to be totally on board with that. And there's also another thing about him is that a lot of the alt-right, they're really disappointed by his strong pro-Israel stance. I mean, I imagine some of them might have been telling themselves that perhaps that was something that Trump was doing just to suck up to the Israel lobby in the United States when he was running for the presidency. But I don't think, again, I think that that there wasn't any misdirection there. I think those are his real views. So I think that what will happen is that this, like the alt-right and the so-called alt-right, they united together, the Milo Yiannopoulos and the Richard Spencers, they sort of got together on the Trump train in 2016. But nowadays, but from now that Trump has been elected, their like goals and their will begin to diverge. So I do see a sort of split in that general sphere between the civic nationalists and the ethno-nationalists.
Are you personally more of a civic nationalist?
Well, I don't really want to classify myself too much. I mean, I realistically, I think civic nationalism is the most workable right now. I mean, I think ethno-nationalism, aspects of ethno-nationalism are entirely legitimate as well.
Are there divides between in Russia with Russian nationalists who, well, Putin, who see, well, Putin's more of a, he's a civic nationalist, but some Russian nationalists support him and some are against him because they feel that he's let in too many immigrants from like Central Asia and the Caucasus region?
That's exactly correct. There's so when Westerners they talk about Russian nationalism, Russian nationalism, they say that Putin is the next Hitler, which is complete nonsense. Some of the more sophisticated ones might perhaps mention Alexander Dugin as the face of Russian nationalism, whereas again that's pretty ridiculous. In
Are
reality,
you a big fan of Dugin?
no. Well, I think his influence is overstated, frankly. So the big split between so there's many different sorts of nationalisms in Russia. So there's the civic or the state nationalists, which have made their peace with their state. So an example of that would be Dmitry Rogozin, or even I would argue even Kalinowski would be part of that grouping. And then there's also another sphere of ethno-nationalists, or people who lean more towards ethno-nationalism. And although it's not a rock solid pattern, they do tend to be more anti-Putin than pro-Putin, although again they come at it from just different perspectives. So in that grouping you have say Sputnik and Pogrom, which is a journal which writes about history. They're big fans of the Russian Empire in particular. And they think that Russia has gone too far in the direction of being influenced by ethnic minorities in a bad way, and by oligarchs who steal the nation's wealth, and they don't view Putin positively at all. But they're big fans of the Russian insurrection in the Donbass, for instance, in Ukraine. But another component which is entirely separate from it, but also within ethno-nationalism, are the neo-Nazis, who support who are anti-Putin, but ironically support Ukraine actually. You have liberal
Oh, I know
nationalists, for
there's, well, there's Ukrainian neo-Nazis who are anti-Russian, but you're saying there's
yeah.
Russian neo-Nazis who are pro-Ukraine.
Yeah. In fact, talking about Russian neo-Nazis, they've become totally splintered after Ukraine, because like probably about 60% of them support Ukraine, 40% support the Donbass. I'd put it that's probably the most accurate estimate. But they're not very politically significant at all, because after the Ukraine events, their influence went from, like, if they were like 10% of the Russian nationalism beforehand. Now they're like 2%. Then there's, of course, the liberal nationalists who are anti-Putin, but heavily pro-Western. So the biggest name in that bucket would be Alexei Navalny.
You posted an article a while back saying that the anti-Putin movement was sort of, well, Putin's support is strongest outside of Moscow, but the anti-Putin movement sort of represents sort of like strongest among like oligarchs and the yuppie class in like the central part of Moscow.
Yes, that's right. And I think it's a very typical pattern. I mean, I'll look at Trump. It's the inner city liberals who are getting really triggered out, the New Yorkers, San Francisco. So Moscow would be the equivalent of that social demographic in Russia.
You talked about kind of the split in the alt-right. So you have like Richard Spencer, and then you have like the civic nationalist types like Cernovich and even Milo. On our last show, you kind of said you identified more with the alt-left, or kind of like the left wing of the alt-right and the kind of stuff we talk about in this show and like the blogger Rabbit?
Well, okay. I mean, I, once again, I don't like to categorize myself. I like to tackle issues individually based on the facts and whether they make sense or not.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So, I mean, culturally, yes, I probably have a lot in common with the alt left, at least as B.W. Rabbit defines it. Economically, I'm considerably further to the right relative to him, and especially Robert Lindsay, I think. I'm basically a centrist, I think.
So maybe like comparable to like Ron Unz?
Yes, I think that's a legitimate way of putting it.
You were recently on Russian TV to talk about Trump. Can you talk about that experience?
Okay, so basically they were asking me for the understandable reasons what Trump entailed for Russia, and whether the United States could now be friends with Russia. This was incidentally for Zvezda TV, which is a sort of military patriotic channel. What I emphasized is that Trump is a nationalist, a civic nationalist, and he's also an economic nationalist. And this has two implications. First of all, he's concerned primarily with the domestic economy and with the state of Americans, especially of normal Americans, the people in so-called flyover country. He's going to be focused a lot on that. That implies less time for various foreign policy adventures, which don't have a habit of working out very well for the United States, and which is probably a good thing. And secondly, he's also the another aspect or consequence of his civic nationalism is that, ironically, it would be easier to get along with an American nationalist for Russia than it would with a American globalist, because nationalists, they're concerned with the national interest. The United States is pretty far away from Russia, whereas a globalist and a globalist ideologue such as the neocons under Bush or the liberal interventionists under Obama, they view the entire world as the sort of sphere of influence of the United States or of American values, to be precise. This obviously would naturally lead to a lot more friction with Russia than it would with someone who's just a proponent of American national interests.
In the past, the big conflicts were between nationalism, different types of nationalism, but in the 21st century, I mean, there's going to be a lot of different battles. I mean, radical Islam is going to be a major factor, but I see a key battle is not between different types of nationalism, but you'll see more cooperation with maybe Russian nationalism and American nationalism as the kind of Cold War legacy wears off. But the real battle will be sort of like this international nationalism to a degree versus a globalism.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. So, I mean, if you go back a century ago, you had a lot of big grievances, France thought Alsace-Lorraine was theirs. So you had lots of these tensions. You had this world of great powers with unstable alliance systems, which would drag everything in. But before the Nazis came to power, you also had these ideas that you need living space. So the populations were still increasing back then by a considerable amount. It wasn't clear that German geopoliticians could argue that Germany needed living space in the East. But nowadays the issues are totally different. So there's no longer these grievances have for the most part receded into the past, and the main challenge now is too many people coming in actually from a nationalist perspective, not in any desire to expand even further. So basically the conditions have changed, and so ironically that puts nationalists in a position where they can actually cooperate with each other. So would have sounded very strange, of course, 100 years or even 50 years ago, but that's the reality today.
I was thinking about, because we were talking about neo-Nazis and such, I was thinking about the national Bolsheviks, you know, those funny guys with the hammer and sickle, but it's a black icon and a white circle and a red background. You know, it's just like the iconic swastika flag, but instead it's the hammer and sickle instead. And I was thinking to myself, you know, thinking about Ukrainian neo-Nazis, I've seen these people too, the national Bolsheviks online. Do you know about them and or about what they do, or is that kind of was a fad?
It's mostly a fad. So, I mean, they don't have any relations to Ukrainian nationalism at all. So national Bolshevism, actually, I think, was mostly created by a guy called Eduard Limonov, who is a Jewish homosexual. So not an insult that he's a bisexual, actually, who emigrated to the United States when it was back in the Soviet days and returned to Russia in the early 1990s. He's a very interesting character, very idiosyncratic. It's like one of those people who like always coming up with weird but crazy but interesting ideas. And the national Bolsheviks, for the most part, that was him who created it. And they've got this really weird mix of beliefs, involving occultism, and a large part of it is Stalin as well. But it's not a mass movement. It's not very influential.
That sounds it sounds interesting, because it's like, who know you'd see a hammer and sickle looking like a swastika flag. And I feel like if people were to fall for that, then certainly people would fall for different variants or even subgenres of things, you know. You could say punk mm-hmm. hardcore to digital hardcore, or neo-Nazi Aryanism to Asian Aryanism. But there's this this thing where it's like, it's people get into this subgenre thing and they make it a lifestyle-ism. And so as long as it's this powerful thing, it could really snowball and happen. But I just think that's funny you point that out, where it has those roots in there, compared to if you were to really make an authentic, like, if we're talking about the alt-right, you know, is that just a subgenre of the right as whole? or is there going to be like a diverse alt-right in the future where like African-Americans will make their own alt-right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Called Afro-alt-right, and that'll be a thing.
Well, it's called BLM.
Oh, yeah.
So, with your return to Russia, what were some of your first observations of Moscow, and how has the city and country changed since the last time you were there?
So the last time I was there is 10 years ago. So it has changed a lot, and for the most part, for the better. So it's a lot more civic, I would say, a lot more polite than it was. And it was 10 years ago, so I mean, I could cite many examples, but the one example that I would cite is, say, traffic and crossing the roads. Back in the 1990s, you had to look both ways when you were crossing, like even at the designated zebra crossing, to make sure, because like nobody bothered stopping. Nowadays, it's comparable to London in that respect. It's there's a lot more things on sale, so more consumer choice. Although right now, not a lot of people are buying because Russia hasn't fully exited the recession yet. But there's a lot of choice. So another change is of course the ethnic balance. If 10, 15 years ago, it was about 95% Slavic. Nowadays, I would say it's about 80% Slavic. So still a lot more white than London, say, which is basically 50-50 at this point. And
by 50-50, is that white British, or that's also including other Europeans and Eastern European immigrants?
So according to the last census, British whites were 45% of the London population, according to the last census a few years ago. And total whites maybe 60%, but I mean, when you walk the streets, my basic impression was that it was about 50-50. And I think it makes sense because, I mean, it's mostly younger people who go out more frequently than older people. And
the other factor you also have to take into account, I mean, I was in London in 2002 for several days, and you see a lot of tourists who are English, but they're coming in from other parts of England, so that kind of skews the perception if you go to the touristy areas.
Oh, yeah, certainly, but I mean, I wasn't around the tourist areas most of the time because I was there for 2 months, and that's first. Secondly, I was there in October, November, which is not exactly tourist season.
Do you think there's this whole kind of concept that's been put out by, like, Eurabia? Do you see that as, like, a scaremongering, or do you think that's a real possibility that a lot of these countries like England, France, Germany, Belgium, Sweden could become majority Muslim in the next, 50 years?
I don't think they'll become majority Muslim in the next 50 years. I think what's more likely is that there'll be a sort of like what happened in Lebanon. So it was majority Christian back in the early 20th century, but then, due to faster Muslim economic demographic growth and the influx of Sunni Muslims, Christians are now just 30% of the population there, and politics are really splintered along ethnic lines. And I think this is basically what will happen in Europe, and for that in Europe as well. I think the left wing parties, talking of just the next 50 years, I think the left-wing parties, the socialists in France, for instance, Labour in the UK, they'll become the party of the ethnic minorities, including of the Muslims, whereas the right-wing parties, they'll become the parties of the whites, including of the working classes.
Yeah, you mentioned Lebanon. I was reading somewhere the demographics went from about like 70% Christian about 100 years ago to about 30% today. I mean, that's a really dramatic demographic transformation. So it is possible. If nothing is done about immigration, Europe could see that same level of demographic transformation.
So yeah, I don't think there'll be a Udabia in the sense that European countries will be ruled by Islamic states in 2070 or whatever. But if the immigration isn't brought under control, then I could definitely see them expanding to 10, 20, even 30% of the population. Who knows? Although ironically, as their share of the population increases, so institutional quality will go down. GDP per capita might stagnate because the new immigrants are less intelligent, less productive than natives. So ironically, that'd be less incentive for third worlders to migrate there as a result of this. So,
I don't know if this is just kind of like scaremongering or how legitimate this is, but I was reading somewhere that the migrant crisis is so bad that people in like France and Germany are actually considering like immigrating abroad. And that's kind of a parallel to what happened in Lebanon with like Muslim immigration came in, a lot of them Palestinian refugees. A lot of Christians immigrated to the West. So could you see that theme, like trend
like Nicholas Nassim Taleb, right?
Oh yeah.
He's a great guy. You should follow him on Twitter and read his.
You said Nassim? Are you talking about Nassim Taleb?
Yes.
But could you see that same trend with Europe?
Well, to an extent, we are already seeing it. I'm not sure about France, specifically with respect to Germany and Britain, both of those countries have very substantial immigration rates. So in Britain, it's for understandable reasons. There's Australia, the United States. They're sort of better for the more intelligent, more entrepreneurial. Young British people than is Britain itself, but Germany's case is more worrying. There's also substantial immigration as well from Germany.
To what country specifically? You're talking the United States, or more likely from like Germany to like neighboring countries like Switzerland, Denmark, and the Czech Republic.
I think it's mostly they're going to the United States and to Australia, maybe to Canada.
And do you think that could reverse America's like demographic trends?
Well, not with the sorts of numbers that are coming in right now, obviously. But if the domestic situation becomes a lot worse, then I could see that happening. Yes.
You've made some predictions back in 2016, a year ago, about a year ago. Which of those predictions have come true and which have not? I think first to start off with, the big one was, I remember there was this talk of Saudi Arabia and Turkey invading Syria to topple Assad. And there was a prediction of like World War III, but that ended up just being like a saber rattling. Out of those predictions, which ones have come true and which ones have not that you made?
Well, wait, I didn't make that prediction.
Oh, you did? Okay.
No. I said that Assad will be the main president of Syria with a 90% confidence rate, and that is indeed what happened. I didn't predict anything particularly radical with respect to Syria. I predicted that things would remain largely unchanged with respect to Ukraine, and that is indeed what happened. There's been no further uptick in the fighting there. The U.S. will impose in no fly zone in Sicily, I gave it a 10% chance. And it didn't happen. So,
would you say your big prediction that you were wrong about was about you predicted Hillary Clinton would be elected?
Yeah, like many people, I did think that.
I mean, so did I at some point too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did consistently give Trump higher numbers than the opposition, and like in the final, my final prediction before the elections themselves, I even gave him winning Michigan, which I'm quite happy with. But I wasn't sure. I predicted that he'd lose Florida, though. And that didn't happen. I thought that the Hispanics would be more pissed off with him than was actually the case.
You also predict the migrant arrivals declining to Europe this year, but I mean the migrant crisis is still a huge issue. But you see it continuing, but at a slower rate than in 2015 and even 2016.
Well, yeah, I mean, 2015, it was just a flood, and since then, it's gone down, obviously. It wasn't a particularly hard prediction, I would say.
Did you notice the effects of the migrant crisis when you were in London?
Well, it's hard to separate it from previous immigration, because, I mean, as I said, London is basically a 50% white city now. Who are the new arrivals and who are the old arrivals? Obviously, you can't really tell that with an eye glance. Although when I was living there, a few blocks from where I lived, there was some sort of migrant legislation office or something along those lines, and there were substantial queues all the time there. And at least 90% of the people in those queues did look third world. I mean, only a few of them looked like Syrians or Arabs. Most of them were blacks, actually.
Yeah, that was my observation in London in 2002. I would say the largest groups were South Asians, followed by blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Besides demographics, what have been the other biggest changes you noticed in London?
So I had a big blog post about this, London Impressions. So what other things I noticed is that the economy does seem to be booming, or the construction industry at any rate. That's on the positive side of things. I found that I like fish and chips quite a lot more than the last time I tried them, which was more than a decade ago.
Have you ever had Chip Buddies? I love the Chip Buddies. That's an English food I like.
No, I haven't. What is that?
That is basically French fries between bread with mayonnaise and mustard, and they have it at soccer games. That's the only English food I ever really enjoyed, Chip Buddies.
Okay.
What do you think about the whole construction boom and skyscraper boom going on in London?
Well, I guess it's good for the capitalists and the property class. I mean, the housing prices are ridiculous, however. The studio I was staying at. Well, it's actually a one bedroom apartment. I was staying with a relative. It's close to the center, admittedly, but still,
are
it's a one bedroom apartment.
The West End and or the Financial District?
It's very close to the center. It's a few blocks from London Bridge and the Tower of London. And that apartment costs, I think it cost half a million pounds sterling to buy. So that's pretty ridiculous.
I'm a big fan of a lot of the, like, 60s kind of futuristic architecture that they have. Like, some examples of that are Center Point, which is kind of on the eastern fringe of the West End, and also, like, the BT Tower in Fitzrovia. Are you a fan of that kind of architecture?
Not really, no. I think architecture reached its peak.
Do you know the buildings I'm talking about? Center Point and the BT Tower.
Oh, okay, yeah. I see it now. Well, it looks interesting, but I'm not a huge fan of any sort of 20th century architecture.
How big is the Muslim population there in England? I wouldn't know, but from what I hear, it seems like it's a problem.
According to the last census, it's 5% of the population, which is a doubling over the last census. So that 10 years ago, when there were 2.5% of the population.
You had a funny comment. You said that London is too damp and gloomy and too vibrant, as in too vibrant diversity. You prefer it the other way around. That was kind of funny. It does remind me of my trip to the Bay Area when we met up in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. The first 2 days I spent in Walnut Creek, which was like Walnut Creek is a very kind of hot, sunny, Southern California weather, but it's also majority white. And then the second 2 days I stayed in another city called Daly City, which is a majority Asian city, but it's very kind of a gloomy. You're saying that you don't like gloomy weather and diversity.
I mean, in that sense, London has the worst of all worlds. I mean, so this is, well, I mean, climatic differences are just personal, but I dislike cold, damp weather, and especially windy when it's also windy, as it is, as it frequently is in London. So I'm not a huge fan of that. And with respect to the diversity, so one observation you can make is that when you go out, so London is really diverse, and so is the Bay Area is very diverse, extremely diverse, and so. But there's also different kinds of diversity. So if you go out in London, then you'll be guaranteed to see at least a few women in the cabs during your trip, during your walk through London. So, and the cab is more hardcore than the hijab. The hijab is just a sort of shawl, which like even some of the more traditional Catholics and Orthodox used to wear. And whereas the niqab is the black garment which leaves everything hidden except the eyes.
In the United States, I've seen plenty of hijabs, but I don't think I've ever seen like a full-on niqab, or if I have, it's extremely rare.
I've seen a few niqabs in the Bay Area, but it's something that happens once or twice a year. And it's actually the same in Moscow. So the Muslims here don't really wear niqabs either. I've been here 2 months and I've seen it twice, and that's it. I won't be amazed if they're actually like Saudi visitors or whatever. But in London, it's you can be guaranteed to see several niqabs whenever you leave the house for like a few hours.
One other observation you made in about Russia is that the bureaucracy has improved. It used to be that it took forever to fill out paperwork, and now it's still an issue, but it's not as bad as it used to be.
Yeah, that's. I mean, there's been a lot of moves to transition to an electronic government in Russia, which is pretty important because Russia is it's a more corrupt country than the West. It doesn't have like Western or not West European attainment rate standards of institutional standards. So it should actually be more of a priority to get electronic government going in Russia, because it's harder to play different scams and stuff like that over the internet than it is in person.
I was impressed by the transit in London, the London Underground. How would you compare the Moscow metro system to both the London Underground and the Bay Area BART?
Well, the BART is nothing home to write about. It's very expensive and it's always on strike. I'm not a fan of BART at all. And the sort of people who use BART, like a lot of people in the Bay Area, they prefer commuting by car. So it's, to be very frank, on average, it's like a lot of the really lower class people go on BART, which isn't great. In London, it's very expensive. It's also expensive as in the Bay Area, but it does have an advantage in that they've implemented this contactless card system a couple of years ago, in which you can actually just use your credit card to pay for wherever you're going. And it's pretty convenient, at least when it works. I've had a couple of cases where it refused to register my credit card for whatever reason. But it doesn't have Wi-Fi, amazingly. Even though London is this global metropolis, its underground doesn't have Wi-Fi. And the Moscow Underground does, by the way, have Wi-Fi. I think it was introduced 3 years ago now. Very well, and it's considerably cheaper. It's quite a lot cheaper than in London or in the Bay Area.
What's interesting about the Moscow Underground, it was built during communism, but I've seen photos of it. It's actually very opulent, the stations are.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the stations built especially under Stalin. So like in the 1930s and 1950s, they are very, very good. The outlying stations, they are not as opulent. But yeah, I mean, the center point stations, they do have character, and it's pretty uplifting to walk through them.
You make predictions about Russia. You predict that Russians will have a better opinion of the United States this year due to Trump, mostly. And you also predict a population growth. Can you comment on some of your, and also that Crimea remains Russian? Can you comment more on some of your predictions about Russia for 2017?
Okay, so as background, every year I make a series of predictions, and I also attach my confidence rate to those predictions, so that say, like, when I predict 70% chance that this will happen, then everything that's predicted at 70%, I should get 7 out of 10 of those predictions right. If I'm any good at predicting, if I'm bad, then that number will be different. So by way of background, that's just how I work. So with respect to the Russia predictions, so I think the most important one which I lead with is that I think that the next is that Putin will be president again for his second term or his fourth term in total, and if he's running, he's going to be announcing it this year, and I think he'll do it. 90% chance that will happen. Yes, I do think that the United States. That Russia's approval of the United States will rise substantially this year, simply because it just plummeted to these absolute depths in the past 2 years. It's pretty hard to imagine that they can go any further down. But what I actually predicted more specifically is that Russians have a more positive view of the US than of the EU as of the last opinion poll this year. So traditionally, Russians have regarded the EU as like more positively than they did the United States. But I suspect that this might flip this year because if Trump follows through on his promises to try to restore relationships with Russia, whereas the EU, especially Germany, remains very hostile, then I could certainly see that inversion happening.
Would you say Trump is relatively popular in Russia compared to other parts of the world?
Absolutely, yes. Three times as many Russians supported Trump as they did Hillary Clinton. So I think the last opinion poll, the opinion poll which was done on how Russians would vote for the U.S. president, I think something like 40% supported Trump, 10% supported Hillary Clinton, and the other 50% didn't have a strong opinion. Well, understandably, because I mean a lot of people are apolitical. What's interesting is that Russia was actually, there wasn't just this big gap between support for Trump and Hillary Clinton, but it was actually also the only country in which the only major country in which more people supported Trump at all than supported Hillary Clinton.
Are you saying the only country?
Yes.
Were there any others? I would think maybe Serbia because of what Clinton did in Kosovo.
Serbia would have been very similar to Russia, no doubt, but they weren't polled. But yes, they would have been. But I'm only speaking of the countries that were polled. So like of the major countries.
With birth rate trends, what happened is the Russian birth rate sank to a very low level because of economics. But as the economy improved, the birth rates recovered. Why do you think that is, in contrast with a country like Germany, which has very low birth rates but has been fairly prosperous?
So this is a huge topic. So the 101 on this is that fertility rates did plummet in the 1990s because that was a period of economic crisis. They plummeted throughout Eastern Europe, in fact, after the collapse of the socialist system. And since the early 2000s, fertility rates in Russia at any rate have indeed recovered. Along with the economy. So even though Russia is currently just emerging out of a recession, its economy is still like 10 times better than it was in the 1990s, even regardless of the sanctions and of the collapse in oil prices. There's just no comparison with the state of the Russian economy in the 1990s.
With your predictions, do you predict a strong possibility of a major war in the Middle East, either involving like a Sunni versus Shia conflict or a major war involving the United States or Israel?
No, I don't. I mean, in any one year, the chances of a major conflict breaking out are very low. I mean, it's just based on statistics.
Yeah, I remember 5 years ago there was all this hype about a major war with Iran, but that never happened.
Yeah, it didn't happen.
I was just thinking about the whole diversity thing that's happening, you know, around the globe, and I'm thinking particular in Philadelphia, where I'm in Chinatown, and I see nothing but, you know, whites going out with Asian females, and that whole... No, I'm serious about this. So, you know, over in England, it's like, you know, you might, I don't know what the multiracial stance there, but it's this kind of thing where, you know, it's the cliche, it's the white female goes out with the black male, and the white male has been going out with the Asian female, and this has been creating this kind of dysfunctional thing that is happening. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know whether this is a part of the trend, you know, it's diverse for every region, especially when I hear it in France or from Roger F. Devlin's speech at NPI, where he was talking about how some of the Scandinavian women are going out with the Muslim men, which is so I would not have never imagined that, you know. And so what's the whole multi-rate, like how popular is the multiracial dating over there in the England, you know, area, you know, is it, or is it less effective and it's not, but I, you know, what's this?
Oh, well, I agree with this observation, and I think there's actually two components to this. So it seems that that women prefer men who are more alpha, or like have a reputation for being alpha, like the Muslims and the Africans for whites, and the white men for Asian chicks. But another component to that is that it's actually the, my impression is that it's the dumber white women who date mm-hmm. Muslims and blacks, whereas it's the brighter white guys who date Asian chicks. And
so it's more like, I don't know, it's like IQ branch. I know what you're saying, because
so yeah, the women go for the alphas, the especially the little woman, and when they cross lines, the men prefer the more feminine and the more intellectual woman.
Yeah, it's like the stronger and intellectual you are, you're going to be with your same race. However, I noticed there's this pattern among white male Asian females where the white male has psychological problems, or at least some kind of self-confidence, doesn't look that mm-hmm. good. And same with what you said about the white woman dating. She's maybe mm-hmm. just a broad, or she goes out and parties
all
the time.
Well, the stereotype is kind of like of a white guy who is intelligent but like nerdy. That's like the stereotype that's put out there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the Asian chicks have a they have a higher tolerance for beta-ness.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
Couldn't you make the case that that's just like extreme, like a case selection? I mean, Northeast Asia is probably even more case selected than Europeans to a degree.
Well, that's P.J. Dushton's theory, yes. It makes sense, yes.
So it would be a natural... So I'm thinking, you know, Russia, they're so, you know, it's, they have healthy normative values where that's why they're so anti, like, gay marriage. You know, everyone works... Everyone's like pro on it, and that's why I think the globalized world really hates Russia, is because they're so hetero and normative, and what you would say they would have like healthy genetics going on, or eugenics or something, compared to the dysgenic nature that's happening in America, where it's this whole frenzy capitalist free-for-all competitive market. People are making wrong choices, or at least is there some kind of bell curve, and now the masses of the lower classes are multiracially mixing in a mutt-like frenzy, and then it shows you that the higher classes, let's say the liberal elite in New York, are actually being more white male, white female, and having healthy things. Or,
well, I wouldn't say Russia actually cardinally differs from that in that respect. With respect to the mixing, I mean, there's quite a few Muslim Slavic, Christian Slavic marriages and relationships, I think. But you're correct that there's a lot less of the shit liberty that you have in the West. So I recently saw a pretty funny meme, which was also accurate. So on the one side, they have like Anglo terms like gender fluid and asexual and bisexual and helicopter kin and you know, all this
yeah.
stuff, and then it had the translation of that term into Russian, and it went faggot, 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 faggot.
I think I know what you're like. I'm trying to self improve myself, and what I do is I eat healthy, I lift weights, I, you know, look good, I shave, I'm trying to improve, you know, the way I speak. And I think there's a lot of young white men in America, which are basically, it's so easy to go get a McDonald's cheeseburger, sit down, play video games, watch anime, and it's so to plug out. And that has become a culture in itself, where the alt-right is saying, do healthy things, like this weird King of the Hill, go play sports, jock mentality, yet that Chad or jock mentality is not really helping mm-hmm. at all. And I feel as that there needs to be a mix between the two, where it becomes mm-hmm. maybe something of Yukio Mishima's classic Sun and Steel, where the stoic man who does his discipline, where he goes, works out, then goes to church, and probably is a strong virgin. I don't know.
I like that.
Clark Kent, strong virgin. That's how I look at myself.
Well, I suppose, I mean, the celibacy, sexual frustration can be a creative outlet. I mean, why not? I think that's that seems to make sense if you look at history.
One more topic I'd like to touch upon is Michael Hudson and the fire economy, and the whole percentage of the economy that is controlled by the financial sector. Anatoly, can you comment on the fire economy and which countries, looking at the major ones like the United States, England, Germany, Russia, Japan, China, which of those have the most significant segment of their economy in the fire economy?
Well, I think it's obviously a lot more prevalent than in the West. And so, I mean, the United States is pretty typical. Actually, I would say that it reaches its highest extent in the United Kingdom, speaking of the major countries. I mean, London, the United States has five times Britain's population, but London is just as strong a financial center as New York, maybe stronger even. Whereas in many other regions, it's the role of financial markets is a lot less significant. So in Russia, for instance, it was traditionally just a casino, basically, and it still is. It doesn't really have any particular relevance to the economy, and I think that's also still the case in China. So, I mean, the economy of China is approaching that of the United States, but the capitalization of its stock market is like 20 times lower.
What do you see as economic solutions to the fire economy, and what are some of the factors of countries that have had strong economies independent, that are not entirely independent of the financial sector, but more independent of the financial sector than, say, the United States or the UK?
Mm-hmm. I view the financial system as basically this thing that allows you to extract a tiny like share of extra efficiency from the economy. It also goes belly up every decade or so, imposing major costs. So I think there's definitely huge public interest in constraining the size of the financial sector. And moreover, I think another point I would make is that the financial industry, like this octopus, they hover in they also hover in like a big percentage of the cognitive capital of a country. So, like all these elite mathematicians and physicists going to work for Goldman Sachs instead of working on radical life extension or nuclear spaceships or whatever. That's pretty bad, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very crucial point to make, but I don't think I've heard anyone make that before. I think you're the first person to say that. You have all these high IQ people, and they're put into something that is not productive. They could be doing all these great contributions to science, to better a civilization, but instead they go into something that's not productive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we should definitely look at rearranging the socioeconomic systems we have in place to favor more the sort of activities that would actually extend the reach of our and potential of our civilization to be a lot more interesting. I mean, really, exactly what are they doing in those Goldman Sachs? They're just like making extra bit of money for their bosses. They're making they're eking out perhaps an additional 2 percentage point increase in the GDP over what it otherwise would have been. But It also imposes a huge cost, obviously, in terms of opportunity cost.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Anatoly Karlin for being on. We've covered a lot of really interesting topics.
Thank you for having me on, and I'm looking forward to further discussions. Thank you, David and Violeta.
Thanks.